to get into the business of our session. The way in which we have organized these reports to the people before is as follows. One, that whatever introductions and preliminary remarks are to be made by others than myself will be made before I start, which shouldn't take more than about 10 minutes. Once I have started, I will speak for not in excess of 15 minutes. In this case, I'll deal with the energy problem, which seems to be very much on people's minds. At the end of that time, we'll open the floor to questions. And in asking questions, if you would be kind enough to line up at either the first or second of these microphones, and we'll call you in turn, we would greatly appreciate it if whatever question you asked or whatever explanation you wish to give respecting the question would be confined to 2 minutes. And in fairness to others, I will, if you will allow me, let you know when 2 minutes have expired so that I might answer your question and we can move on down the line. Finally, you will find distributed either on your seats or there will be distributed a plain index card. If any of you, which looks like this, if any of you are interested in getting on the mailing list so that you can get annual reports or other mailings that are sent out from time to time from my office in Washington, if you'll just be good enough to put your name and address on the card, we'll put you on the mailing list. Now, I wish to express my gratitude to the State University at Farmingdale for the accommodation of permitting me to have the report to the people in the Roosevelt Auditorium. President Laffan happens to be in Albany. I wish to pay my respects to him and to thank Mortimer Gleason, who's the chairman of the council of this particular part of the State University, for making the arrangements which bring me here today. To thank Mr. Conklin, assistant to the president, and Vice President Zulli, who met me at the helicopter, for making the arrangements here, which seem entirely satisfactory. A number of my colleagues in government are here today. I'm deeply honored, as I feel you should be, ladies and gentlemen, for their attendance. And I would like first to introduce them to you. There are a number of members of Congress from the Nassau-Suffolk area. First, the congressman who actually walked through Farmingdale, if I saw properly from the papers, Congressman Roncalo, who's right here. And then your own Jim Grover, who represents a large part of Suffolk. And Congressman Norman Lent, for a long time a state senator. Now, as to local officials, I would like first to introduce to you Tom DeVivo, who is the Chief Deputy County Executive of Nassau. Mr. DeVivo is representing Ralph Queso here, as Ralph is engaged elsewhere and can't attend. I would also wish to acknowledge the presence of Frank O'Connor, Commissioner of the Department of General Services in Nassau. Is he here, Frank? Would you rise? Jim Wells, the Commissioner of Commerce and Industry. Jim? He's not here. Joe Driscoll, the Deputy County Executive for Environmental Affairs of Nassau. And Howard Levitt, Counsel to the Board of Supervisors. Mr. Levitt. Ladies and gentlemen, I also am very deeply gratified and honored that the County Executive of Suffolk, a very distinguished public servant, is here today, and he will speak with you in a minute. Before we came in and before Congressman Roncalo and Lent arrived, I had arranged that Jim Grover, the congressman whom I just introduced, might have a word with you. And while he's doing that, I'll see if the other two congressmen would like to say a word. But right now, here's Jim Grover. Thank you, Jack. I thought you were going to give me a bye in view of the increased attendance here, but I can say welcome to Suffolk County, as our distinguished county executive will say. We in the House of Representatives share the mutual problems of our constituency, Jack, and be assured we're going to work together with you beginning next Monday to resolve as many as we possibly can, and perhaps particularly the energy crisis, which is having such a tremendous, made such a tremendous impact and been such a tremendous burden on my constituents as I hear it from them. But thank you very much for the introduction, Jack, and thank you for inviting us here.
Thank you very much, Jim Grover. Now, Congressman Linton Roncalo said that they're content to let Jim express the sentiment of all three members of Congress, so you will please accept his remarks accordingly. And now I have the honor to introduce to you your own gifted executive of Suffolk County, John Klein.
Thank you, Senator. Ladies and gentlemen, I will recognize the fact that this is an opportunity for you to meet with Senator Javits and to express your views to him and receive his. I simply want to extend to the Senator a warm welcome to Suffolk County, which is the formal part, and the even more important part is to extend to him our deep gratitude for coming to Suffolk County for this very type of open, freewheeling forum. I assure you, Senator, that probably among the most pervasive and perplexing problems to the 1,250,000 people of Suffolk County and equal number or greater number in Nassau today is the scope of the energy crisis, its impact on their daily lives, and their ability to cope with problems that they encounter in this bi-county region. I also say to you that we in local government, and I know that I speak on behalf of my counterpart, Nassau County Executive Ralph Caso, when I say that we in local government are hungry for assistance and leadership such as you have provided, the congressman present have provided, in getting from the federal administration the kind of straight answers on this issue that, number one, we need, and number two, we deserve, and we thank you very much for your assistance.
Thank you very much, Mr. Klein, and my colleagues in the Congress, and Mr. DeVivo. Thank you all very much. Ladies and gentlemen, in my session here with you today, I'd like to introduce to you the members of my staff who work on these particular issues. This is a working session, not given to oratory, but to information. And the gentleman who is sitting here is Charles Warren, who is my legislative assistant and in charge of the flow of legislation through my office, and under him work a number of lawyers and others, including Gary Klein. Where is Gary? Gone out. Well, he will have him back in a minute. And the young woman who handles state and local projects, like those involving, for example, contracts at Fairchild, which is but a step away from here, is Kelly Costley, who is standing against the wall. And my representative touring the state is George Van Riper, who is standing against the wall. Now to the energy crisis. The two major questions which all of us must face in this regard are, is it a real crisis? And to that, my answer is an unequivocal yes, always bearing in mind that one must give or take the usual 10% for chiseling, profiteering, discrimination, and the normal acquisitive desire of individual companies, no matter how big, to make all the money they can, crisis or no crisis. But granted all of those variables, and all of them need correction in terms of our antitrust laws and other aspects of federal law, both in effect and which will be in effect, there is a real crisis, and I'll endeavor to demonstrate that to you shortly. Second question, what can our government do to meet the crisis? And my answer to that is that we can legislate to ensure that we're able to obtain and make public the needed meaningful information to demonstrate that there is a crisis. We are able to and must make sure that there is a fair allocation by region and individual need of the available supplies, and both are important, region and individual need, as both are quite variable. And third, that profits are not made unduly and unfairly from the crisis. This can be done through taxation, with the alternative to those who are earning excess profits, and right now, there's, from every indication, the oil companies are, the alternative of plowing back those profits into further exploration for sources of oil or experimentation to discover new sources for energy, such, for example, as the liquefaction or gasification of coal, the extraction of oil from oil shale, the further development of the process of getting power from atomic energy, etc. Now as to the details respecting these questions. First, is there an energy crisis? Now, my friends, I would be less than realistic and less than sophisticated, and I think I'm both, if I didn't tell you that I feel it my duty to speak directly and frankly on this subject, notwithstanding that I run the grave political hazard of being misunderstood as some kind of an apologist for oil companies, as the suspicion and the cynicism is widespread. I welcome suspicion and cynicism, and I'm perfectly willing to submit to whatever tests they provide. But I believe that it would be a very grave disservice to our country if people were induced to believe that this crisis is solely attributable to the desire of oil companies to make some extra dough, and that therefore all of the self-disciplinary measures which we urge in the use of electricity and the use of automobiles and the closing of gas stations and in many other economies, the public would tend to forego or violate because it didn't believe there was really a crisis. And so I believe it essential for men in authority, notwithstanding the political danger. It's always so easy to tear somebody else down and to say, see, he's the bad one, I'm the good guy. But I believe you've got to tell the people the truth, and you've got to be able to prove it's the truth if you expect them to undertake the disciplinary measures and the sacrifice which is here involved. Now, the reason I say the energy crisis is real, especially for this part of the country, is because, one, there is a diminution in supply, and it's a serious diminution in supply. It involves something in the area of 10 to 15% of oil supplies, and something in the area of 6 to 7% of the aggregate utilization of fuels for energy of all kinds. But it happens to hit the New York area and the Northeast with a special heaviness, double its average impact, in other words, not 10 to 15, but 20 to 30 in this area for these reasons. One, we underuse, especially gasoline, because of the mass transit and similar facilities in the New York metropolitan area. And we use about half the per capita gasoline that's used in any similar comparable population grouping in the country, whether that grouping is in Los Angeles or in Houston, Texas, or in the Chicago area, or wherever there occurs such a heavy population group. Secondly, a pattern has grown up when energy seemed limitless, in which this particular part of the country, because it had a deficiency in refinery capacity and for other transportation reasons, relied over heavily on imports. Now, if imports were assured, that's all right. In other words, you do your utmost to provide for the most economical source of supply, and you are not particularly scared of the fact that it's imports that does it in a particular part of the country rather than indigenous production. And that's what happened here. But in this case, it worked out very badly, because when the crunch came, which was very sudden, very unexpected in terms of the oil embargo, we were hit by it extremely hard. So that It is essential in our interest, indeed in our interest more than that of any other part of the country, that there be allocations and rationing, because that is the only way, in my judgment, in which we're going to get a fair break, considering the historical pattern built up in this area. And that is, I might say, complicated in the case of heating oil by the fact that there's an overdependence by independent wholesalers, from whom independent retailers derive their supplies, on imported oil in this area of the country, particularly on Long Island, which has put Long Island at very particular hazard. Now, the historic basis upon which that came about is simply that there were wholesalers in this part of the country who were more enterprising than others and weren't intimidated by the fact that there were many big companies in the field, and they went into business too. But they had to draw much of their supply from imported sources. And as I said before, that's all right if things are going well. Now it puts us all in a terrific bind. The other part of the problem, to which I think you should all understand, is that we have had a growing deficiency in supply even without the Arab oil embargo. And that is the reason for that is that our tremendous use has simply soaked up all of the domestic supply which it was economic to produce. Now, at these prices, which the Arabs are now holding us and the world up for, it is very economical to produce from lots of other sources and to dig deeper, whether it's for coal or gas or oil. And undoubtedly, we will materially increase our domestic supply in the next 3 to 5 years. But you can freeze to death many times in 3 to 5 years, and also be immobilized as a nation, both economically and in terms of the wheels rolling. So that though that's a fact, it doesn't do us much good in this immediate emergency situation in which we're cast. Hence, and this is the conclusion, notwithstanding the vigilance, and I know I speak for all my colleagues, the vigilance which we will exercise, and the strong action which we will vote for in terms of power in the government and restraints upon those who would exploit us under the guise of crisis, we are still going to have a problem. And hence, the cooperation of the people in terms of conservation and self-discipline is absolutely indispensable to our nation. And in those terms, it is a very real crisis. Now, I believe that with that kind of cooperation to which I refer, we can get out of this crisis in 1 year, and we can get out of it without its having a materially adverse effect on employment or even the economy. Now, in that regard, there are two factors. One, that we should give an adequate priority not only to fuels but also to petrochemicals, that is, the derivative of fuels, in order to keep our farms and factories working. And the United States government in its policy so far has made that the first priority, aside obviously from public health and public safety, which we all would understand. But the first priority is to see that we don't suffer a serious recession or depression. And that means maintaining the job level and not starving the business community for essential supplies needed to operate American business. And I repeat, that includes not only the various fuels, but also the petroleum derivatives derived from these fuels in order to keep plastics and other industries with wide, what's called ripple effect, working. So that's point one. And secondly, we're lucky in that we've had overuse, so that when we cut down on use, we may be cutting fat, but we're not cutting bone. Thirdly, price is a very big point. The staggering prices now being exacted for imported oil based upon this Arab embargo will bankrupt the world, and they simply cannot be endured. Now, how the world will manage is a total international problem to which we're now addressing ourselves in the invitation to consuming nations to combine together as the producing nations have combined together, especially in the Arab world, and to meet with them in an effort to resolve that unbelievably complex and dangerous financial problem. But as far as we're concerned, we can live without the imported oil, which comes at these very, very high prices, if we take the measures which are now on the drawing board. Hence the additional reason why the United States should not permit itself to be bled for roughly $25 billion a year, which the previous rate of imports would cost us at present prices, by doing its utmost to cut down on the need for imports, one, by the discipline, self-discipline of the nation and underuse, whereas heretofore we've had overuse, and second, by the discovery of new sources. And we've already begun in that direction through the development of the legislation for the Alaska pipeline and in pushing in other directions, including the extraction of coal, an acceleration of the discovery of domestic sources of oil, and I refer to oil, shale, etc. And the turnaround time, as I say, I estimate at roughly in the three-year period, and the surmounting of the crisis, provided we do what's needed, I estimate on the one-year basis. And I believe that should be reassuring to our people, especially as we have every right to rely upon us legislators who are sitting up here today to see that no one exploits us under the guise of a crisis, and that black markets, profiteering and discrimination among customers, etc., is held in control. Now, finally, there is one bill pending which almost passed at the end of the last session of Congress, called the Emergency Energy Act, which failed of passage through a mini filibuster in the Senate, enough to defer it until we come back, which is next Monday. That particular measure gives added powers to the federal government to deal with the energy crisis. I can, if you wish, in the question period, give you the exact details of what it does. For example, it authorizes the promulgation of rationing, emergency rationing and conservation plans, and to make them mandatory by law. It authorizes power plant conversion to coal with respect for and consideration for environmental dangers. It authorizes ordering maximum production in the oil fields, including the oil fields of the southwestern states, where they have state-imposed quotas in order to prevent an exhaustion of their oil reserves. And it provides special assistance in various forms, including mass transit, which is a very, very critically important thing to us, under the cover of the energy emergency, in order to encourage mass transit as against the individual transportation and cars. So the first order of business when we come back to Congress will be the passage of the Emergency Energy Act, and I'm confident that it will be passed in a matter of days after we come back, as a filibuster is only was effective because it was the very end of the session, there was one day left to go, and any one senator could cause the bill to fail. Now, included in that measure is an excess profits tax, which was put on by the House, and I'd like to tell my House colleagues that I'm with it, and that I hope we include it. Whether we need it or not at this particular moment, it is important to reassure our people that there will be no excess profits gained out of the exploitation of this emergency. And therefore, I believe that it should stay in the bill and not, as a number of senators wish, be taken out. Well, now, ladies and gentlemen, I've exhausted my time. I've exhausted my time as to a direct presentation on energy, and we'll now go to questions and answers. Now, the questions and answers may be on any subject, whether I've covered it or not in my presentation. And if it's on anything I don't know about, I will tell you so. If it's a federal matter, I'll undertake to communicate the answer to you and to make it public. If it's a local or state matter, it'll depend upon the particular issue which you raise.
I could give it to the people.
Ladies and gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, just one announcement, especially to those who are lined up to ask me questions. In about a half hour, I shall have to declare a short recess in order to draft and issue a statement on the impending announcement by the governments of Israel and Egypt respecting a disengagement of their forces in respect of the Suez Canal. But we'll do that as soon as the full information is in, which is not yet. Yes, sir.
Senator,
give us your name and then your question.
Senator Javits, my name is Gilbert Winnis. I'm a resident of Farmingdale. It seems to me that in a period of crisis, we always seem to wait until the crisis is upon us. The Russians launched Sputnik, and we followed through with our space program. I just wonder if sometime in the future it's not possible to take into account a crisis before it is imminent.
Well, you're very, that's very understandable point, and you're absolutely right. And giving you a long story going back to 1970 as to what I tried to do to call attention to the fact that we were bound to have a crisis on oil would get you nowhere and get me nowhere. That is the fact, though. And I'm sure that every one of my colleagues could give you a roughly similar history. The fact is, however, that the people, as well as the administration, have to be ready. And in this case, the people were just as little interested as was the administration. We're all at fault. And even though I was, and I could justify my own record as being ahead of the parade, and I'm sure my colleagues could, that doesn't help us. We have a collective responsibility. I can assure you, however, that I will move heaven and earth to see that even if the Arabs lift the embargo tomorrow and cut their prices back to where they were, that we still go ahead to do all the things we have to do in order to get reasonable self-sufficiency in respect of energy.
Do we have a mechanism, sir, to keep up with what's going on and to foresee and take into account and take the proper steps beforehand?
Well, sir, generally we allow only one question, but I'll answer that one. We do have the mechanism. It's not as perfect as it should be, but we have the committees of Congress, we have the periodic reports of the Executive Department, and we're now working on sharpening up the Congress so that it has better machinery itself in order to keep abreast of these things. I still feel myself that we need some more effective national agency respecting long-term resource deficiencies and development, and I've got measures in for that purpose.
Thank you, sir.
We do have machinery for the purpose.
Thank you.
Yes.
Senator, my name is George Barnett. I don't think anybody questions the need for conservation, nor do we question the necessity of developing self-sufficiency through oil shale and distilling of oil from coal. However, in the last few weeks, there have been a number of remarks printed and spoken. For example, the article by Christopher Rand in the Times and the comments of Governor Mandel and of the head of the National Maritime Union and the Lloyd's of London study, which suggests that, in fact, the Arab embargo is illusory, that, in fact, oil exports by the Arab countries have increased in 1973, and over a 10-day period during the supposed embargo, there was absolutely no decrease in crude oil exports. It's very difficult, I would think, for the American people, at least it's been difficult for me, to believe that there is a real decrease in oil imports when we hear comments like this and read articles like this, and when all of a sudden the petroleum companies stop printing statistics and information seems to be contradictory from all sources. What specific provisions are there in the new legislation, or what specific provisions do you think we should have to ensure that the American people will get accurate information, not information just disgorged by the petroleum companies?
That's an excellent question, and I'd answer it gladly. First, there was a hearing last Monday before the Joint Economic Committee, of which I have the honor to be the ranking Republican member, in which Mr. Simon told us what legislation he felt he needed in order to get mandatorily the necessary factual information. I told them that I would, and Senator Proxmire said he would, introduce legislation for it. Secondly, a vastly increased authority to get figures is contained in this Emergency Energy Act, to which I referred a minute ago, and we have every right to feel that confidentiality, if justified, can be asserted in the courts, and we shouldn't just leave it to the oil companies as to what they think is confidential. Now, as to the matter of leakage in the Arab embargo, there is leakage in the Arab embargo. And though we are totally embargoed, whereas Europe and Japan are not, and undoubtedly these increased supplies are going to Europe and Japan, which are trying to build up, unquestionably, greater reserves than they have, there is even some leakage to the United States. And Simon testified to that. He estimated it to be perhaps as much as 1,200,000 barrels a day out of a deficiency of roughly 3 million. But I ask you, in all logic, can a great nation build its policy upon the theory that leakage, which could be stopped any minute, will be continued? Obviously, we cannot. And that, hence, means that while it's good, it's welcome, and it piles up stocks, which we may have to use tomorrow, we can't base our policy on that. Finally, the Investigation Subcommittee of the Government Operations Committee, on which I sit, will begin hearings on Monday, and the greatest and most specific detail on these very points which you mentioned. And I assure you that I am determined, and again I know my colleagues feel the same way, to follow those through wherever they may lead and to see that there are the necessary corrections.
Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
My name is Jean Wilkins-Denver, Senator Javits, and I've written to you on a number of occasions about the conditions of minority and our problems in lack of jobs and so on. I want to comment to you that I saw that you had a black man driving your car when I came in, but as you note, there are no black people sitting on this podium. I'm distressed about the lack of representation there because it speaks to all of our priorities, and there are some black people that take exception to the racism in this country and sympathize with a minority nation that is trying to pull some heavy dealing on a white racist nation so that we don't all see it the same way. I think that's important to note. I would like to ask you that since the NAACP has instituted a suit against the state of New York for prejudicial districting for representation of minorities in the government, do you feel that minority persons in Suffolk County will gain representation because of this suit?